This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you today. Louis Mamadrona from Canada is going to drop by, physician and old friend, talk about the whole healthcare system in crisis. I'll be talking in the second hour of our program with Sterling Burnett, a conservative who's going to suggest we should let the corporate marketplace make energy and transportation decisions, even if it means the destruction of the environment and more 9/11s. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress and Jim Motivalli with the E! Magazine are going to be here for our best of the rest of the news segment in our third hour and your phone calls. But first, Senator John Edwards on the line with us. Senator John Edwards, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I noticed, first of all, regular listeners to my program know that you are the only Democratic candidate to whom I have made any financial contributions. I should just, I guess, by way of disclosure, I visit your website periodically and have made a few donations, and I support
Keep
your
doing
candidacy.
It.
Yeah.
Keep doing it.
and I noticed this morning that there's a big shot there about health care. You're rolling out a new program today.
Yeah, but what happened was back in February, I laid out a very specific universal health care plan. I was the first candidate on either side to do it, and still the only candidate with a truly universal plan. And today I'm in Detroit and talking about some of the things we can do to bring down the cost of health care in addition to covering everybody and taking on insurance companies, taking on big drug companies. Creating some efficiencies that don't exist in the system already.
Specifically, what are the things that you're suggesting we do?
Well, in the case of insurance companies, we want to create competition that doesn't exist today between the insurance companies that are in these health markets that I'm going to set up with my health care plan. Basically, without going through too much detail, there'll be health. Everybody will be covered, required that everybody be covered. There'll be health markets where there's private and public plan. There's a Medicare Plus plan so that people can choose the government plan if they want to. And that creates a competition that doesn't exist today. And then secondly, because insurance companies are spending 30 to 40% of every dollar on administrative costs and profits, we mandate that at a minimum of 85%, 85 cents on each dollar, has to go to patient care.
Yeah,
we reduce these costs.
That seems like just an incredibly important thing. I was staggered last year, or last fall, when the Wall Street Journal revealed that William McGuire, who was the CEO of United Health Group, the second largest health insurance company in the United States, took home $1.6 billion, that his company's stock price tripled from January 2003 to January 2006. Net income in 2005 of $3.3 billion. And this is a company that is basically just moving money around, moving paper around.
That's exactly right. And the cost of health care, it's terrible that we have 45, 46 million people without coverage. That's a moral issue. But on top of that, the costs are just staggering. And we have to desperately need a president that'll take these insurance companies on and make them. They don't need to make that kind of money.
Aren't you concerned? I mean, this is a very, very powerful industry. We talk with Bernie Sanders about this fairly regularly, the health industry broadly. You're going up against some giants here.
Yeah, but that's
that's what you
sort
do.
That's sort of been what I've done my whole life, is take on insurance companies and drug companies and people like that. I think it's going to be necessary to get this done. I mean, one of the things that I would say to America, I'd walk out on the White House lawn and say that this is what we need to do. It's good for America. It'll make us more competitive. It'll cover people who don't have coverage. We're going to reduce costs for everybody. But you can count on the fact that there are going to be millions of dollars spent on television ads fighting what we're trying to do. But what you should ask yourself is, every time you see a television ad fighting against this universal health care plan, who's paying for it? It's either a big drug company or a big insurance company. It's the people who are charging you so much money that you can't continue to pay for your health care. And that's what you need to remember.
You're making this announcement in Detroit, or near Detroit, in suburban Detroit. On the front page of today's Wall Street Journal,
the perfect juxtaposition, a story. Detroit pursues sweeping cuts in union talks, the big three. They're talking about cutting basically $30 an hour. Detroit's big three, facing their worst crisis in decades, are seeking unprecedented concessions in a bid to narrow what they say is a $30 an hour labor cost disadvantage against Asian rivals like Toyota and Honda. Turns out, as you dig into the article, the vast majority of that $30 an hour difference has to do with the fact that the big three are paying health care costs, particularly to retirees, that Toyota and Nissan don't have, you know, that either they're not paying directly or they don't have as many retirees. This speaks right into the jaws of the issue that you're bringing up here.
Well, GM, Ford, and Chrysler spend about $16 billion a year on health care. They've got about $1,700 of health care costs in every car they manufacture, and it makes it impossible for them to compete. And now what's happening is these negotiations are trying to shift that onto the back of workers. That's the net effect of it. And there's a solution to this. America needs a universal health care system that brings down costs for everybody, covers everybody, and so that American business can be competitive and we don't see an already overburdened working people in this country have an additional burden laid on top of them.
Senator John Edwards, Democratic candidate for president. JohnEdwards.com, by the way, the website, and I strongly recommend you check it out. Senator Edwards, tell us a little bit more about the Medicare Plus part of this, please.
Well, basically what I wanted to do is there are a lot of people who believe that what we should do is go from the system we have now to a single-payer system.
Just
entirely correct.
Yeah.
An entire government-run health care system. There's a lot to be said for single-payer. I mean, the administrative costs are much lower. They're more efficient. And certainly in some places, the care is better. And so but we live in a country where people are used to having choices. And my concern was that jump was too much, too fast, that we needed to do something big and bold, cover everybody, real universality, make sure everybody's required to be covered, but that we wanted people to have a choice between a private or a government plan. But the reason for me setting it up that way is because I think people may choose to go to the government plan, the Medicare Plus plan, and the net result of that will be to drive this system to a single payer. So basically that was the concept behind it.
Seems like a real reasonable segue, you know, step by step.
I think it makes sense. We get everybody covered. We do it by getting rid of Bush's tax cuts for rich people, which is how we fund this thing. And on top of that, we bring down costs for everybody.
How's the campaign going?
Going well. I'm all over the country, 16, 17 hours a day. I'm still, you know, we start in Iowa in the nomination process. I'm ahead in Iowa and doing well in basically all the early states. But I think what's going to happen is when we get toward the end of the year and closer to the serious time when voters are choosing a nominee, I think they're going to be looking at very specific proposals that people have made, not rhetoric, but do you have a real universal health care plan? Is it really universal? Do you have a clear, strong, aggressive plan for getting out of Iraq? Do you have a clear plan for addressing global warming? Do you have a plan to end poverty in this country, which is my personal passion, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are going to look very hard at those things, and Democrats want to win. They're going to be saying, you know, among the people who have the best chance of being the nominee, who's the strongest general election candidate? And I think, you know, at the risk of being completely political, I think that all the overwhelming empirical evidence is that I'd be the strongest general election candidate.
I agree. Senator John Edwards, former senator from North Carolina, currently a Democratic presidential candidate, the website johnedwards.com. Senator Edwards, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Great talking with you. It's 15 minutes past the hour. In addition to the issues of health care that John Edwards is talking about, first of all, America is with us on this, but in so many other areas as well. I want to get into some of those right after the break, and then we'll be taking your calls. 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. We'll be right back.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
You were living in a modern world.
Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and join our blog and start blogging. That'll put you in the running for our giveaway today at the end of today's show. My producer, David Poole, in his totally whimsical fashion, is using his wisdom guided by his experience. We'll pick the best comment of the day from our airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. It could be a serious comment, a quick funny one, whatever. That person is going to receive a free autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which just came out in paperback, by the way. You can blog with us at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page for your chance to win that. A lot of you probably caught this on the news yesterday. Some of the news media picked it up and ran with it. Some didn't. But in a hospital in Los Angeles, just to highlight the issue that John Edwards and I were talking about a few minutes ago, in a hospital in Los Angeles, a man brought his wife into an emergency room. She was on the floor, writhing in pain, vomiting blood, and they refused to provide her service. He dialed 911 from inside the emergency room. Here's the call.
911, state emergency. Hold on a moment. Hold on. I'm trying to get an interpreter for you, sir. Un momento. Yes, can you find out what his emergency is, please?
Okay. My wife is dying. The nurses don't want to help her out.
Okay, what do you mean she's dying?
She's vomiting blood. Okay, they're watching her. They're watching her there, and they're just not doing anything.
Paramedics are not going to pick him up or pick his wife up from a hospital because she's already at one. He needs to contact the county police officers at the security desk there.
So that was his initial call. Basically, they said, hey, you're already at a hospital. Good luck. And then his wife is continuing to die on the floor. One of the other people in the emergency room, somebody who is there, we don't know who this person is, somebody who is there who is apparently there with somebody else who had, you know, brought somebody into the emergency room, an unrelated stranger, picks up a phone or uses a cell phone and then dials 911 and has this conversation.
What's your emergency?
There's a lady on the ground and here in the emergency room, and they are overlooking her.
What would you want me to do for you, ma'am?
Send an ambulance out here to take her somewhere where she can get medical help.
Okay, you're at the hospital, ma'am. You have to contact them.
They have a problem. They won't help us. Down on the ground.
Well, ma'am, I cannot do anything for you for the quality of the hospital there. This line is for emergency purposes only.
This is an emergency.
It's not an emergency. It is not an emergency, ma'am.
It is.
It is not an emergency.
To see how they're treating her.
Okay, well, that's not a criminal thing. This line, 911, is used for emergency purposes only. Life-threatening emergencies. It is not. Okay?
May God strike you, too, for acting the way you did
that. No, negative, ma'am. You're the one.
Yeah, she says... I'm not laughing at it. I'm horrified by it. She says, may God strike you. And he says, negative, ma'am. You're the one. I mean, this is absolutely tragic. And the woman died on the floor of the emergency room without any help. This is the state of health care in America. And at the same time, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette runs a story. This was in April of Tuesday, April 18th, 2006, out of Minatoka, Minnesota. About the wonders of William Maguire. When William Maguire switched careers in 1986, he was so restless that a pay cut of more than 30% didn't faze him. Health maintenance organizations were booming, and Dr. Maguire wanted to help run one, so he jettisoned a six-figure income as a pulmonologist in favor of an HMO management job that paid about $70,000 a year. Savvy move. Today, the 58-year-old Dr. Maguire is chief executive officer of United Health Group, Inc., one of the nation's largest healthcare companies. He draws $8 million a year in salary plus bonuses, enjoying perks such as the personal use of the company jet. He also has amassed one of the largest stock option fortunes of all time. Unrealized gains on Dr. Maguire's options totaled $1.6 billion. This is one guy's money. One guy's money. They don't even celebrated CEOs such as General Electric's Jack Welch or IBM's Lou Gerstner never were granted so much during their time at the top. This is a two, and then they point out, Dr. Maguire's story shows how an elite group of companies, George Anders' article, actually originally in the Wall Street Journal, Dr. Maguire's story shows how an elite group of companies is getting rich from the nation's fraying healthcare system. Many of them aren't discovering drugs or treating patients. They're middlemen who process the paperwork. fill the pill bottles, and otherwise connect the pieces of a $2 trillion industry. The middlemen credit themselves with keeping the health system humming and restraining costs, but they're bringing in robust profits, and their executives are among the country's most richly paid. As health and care inflation eased, insurers still raised premiums. This is the beginning of the paragraph. The risk business has been a particular gold mine for United Health and its rivals in recent years. As healthcare inflation eased, right? In other words, as inflation in the healthcare industry eased, insurers still raised premiums at double-digit rates. United Health's stock price tripled between January 2003 and January 2006, helped by acquisitions, although it has fallen back somewhat since the beginning of this year. United Health's net income in 2005 totaled $3.3 billion, nearly four times the figure in 2001. I mean, here we have a billion-dollar CEO. In fact, they say the arrival of the billion-dollar CEO would be a head-turner in any industry, but it's especially controversial in healthcare, where people tend to view each dollar of executive pay as money that isn't spent on them, says Jonathan Weiner, a health policy expert at Johns Hopkins University. And he's right. It's like here you've got these companies paying for the corporate jet and the gold-plated restrooms and God only knows what all. And, of course, profits to the stockholders, profits that when taken in the form of dividends as income to those people who earn their living sitting around the pool on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, only pay a maximum income tax of 15%. These enormous profits in the healthcare industry are doing what? They're leaving America sick. As Michael Moore is preparing to point out with his movie Sicko, and you have an entire industry right now, we're starting to see the early signs of it, an entire industry getting ready to attack Michael Moore. And the idea of, gee, let's do something about this, because boy, is there money to be made. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Better recognize your brothers. Everyone you meet. Why the world are we here? Surely not to live in pain and fear. Why on earth do you care? When you're everywhere, come and get your share. But we all shine on. Like the moon and the stars and the sun.
And we're all working together here to take back America. Speaking of Taking Back America, I'll be doing this show live from the Take Back America Conference in Washington, D.C., Monday, Tuesday of next week. And so tune in and drop by. Ourfuture.org is the website. I'm going to drop by, and I'll be at radio on the radio row there on the main public floor. And I'll also be doing a town hall thing Tuesday morning at 7:30, 8:30, just before Hillary Clinton speaks. So that should be entertaining. This from the news services, as they say in the business. Flexing their newfound political muscle, Native Americans, the only true Americans, have now weighed in on the McCain-Kennedy immigration bill, lobbying Congress to provide for the immediate deportation of all Mayflower descendants. Speaking for the National Council of American Indians, Chief Running Tab at Foxwoods asserted that the Mayflower settlers, quote, not only entered this country illegally without visas or work permits, but behaved very badly, spreading disease, raping our women, despoiling the land, and worst of all, stealing our very identity for their sports teams, end quote. While most tribes oppose any type of amnesty, some have supported a limited trail to citizenship, requiring the Mayflower descendants to pay a fine consisting of their scalps and the return of the Great Plains. Other tribes have proposed a touchback provision requiring the illegal squatters to return to the 17th century for four centuries before applying to live here legally in the present. Some Native Americans would also grant favorable treatment to those who have high-tech skills, such as converting corn to ethanol. The proposal has predictably drawn a huge outcry from WASPs who claim that they're merely doing the jobs that Native Americans refuse to do, such as running investment banks and hedge funds. In addition, although genealogy records reflect that his ancestors arrived not on Plymouth Rock but on Ellis Island, the Indian tribes have also insisted on the unconditional and immediate deportation of Jack Abramoff. Thanks to satirical political Don Davis, lighten the day up a little bit. Christy in El Cajon, California. Hey, Christy.
Hey.
What's up?
I was just listening to you and Senator Edwards, and I have been behind John Edwards since 2003, and I believe he's a great candidate for this country to bring it to where it needs to be. But I also am a member of his One Core group. He's got a group nationwide that does local things. We volunteer here in San Diego, El Cajon area. We volunteer and do beach cleanup. We do food drives. We do raise money for the healthcare industry, and just he's working at getting things done locally. As you say at the end of your show, Tag, you're it. That got me to get off of my butt and get out and do things. And so I am very involved in his campaign and just wanted to let everybody know that when you do go to John Edwards' webpage, johnedwards.com, click on the One Core and find a group in your area and join it and start doing things for your own neighborhood.
That's great. Well, good on you, Christy, and thanks for the heads up on that and the info and for doing it. I mean, that's absolutely marvelous that you're out there doing that. Thanks so much. Dan, driving in Arizona. Hey, Dan.
Good morning, Tom. Hey, two quick points. One that I've never really heard talked about with conservatives who are against universal health care. As an example, I'm a 54-year-old guy, relatively healthy, but take blood pressure meds. And I would like to start my own company, but just the cost of going off of a group policy where I'm employed to an individual policy, the way things are structured right now, prohibits me from starting a company, which is supposed to be small business by conservatives, is supposed to be the backbone of the country.
And right. Well, they give lip service to it, but they actually work for big business and oligarchy and against small business.
I agree, but I'm saying it's like that's why I can't do this. And the second thing is, after listening to Senator Edwards this morning and hearing him previously speak on some of his other serious proposals, he has the same problem you have, and that is he doesn't stand a chance because he's way too intelligent for the average American to get elected.
Neither one of us could become president. Is that your point?
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dan. I appreciate it. I think America is ready for a smart president. We've had a number of smart presidents. Jimmy Carter was a smart guy. John Kennedy was a very, very, very smart man and a very good president. We've had, arguably Richard Nixon was a pretty smart guy, but I don't know. Stephen in North Carolina. Hey, Stephen, what's up? Stephen? No, Stephen. Okay, Bruce in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Bruce.
Hey.
What's up?
Yeah. Is this Tom?
It is, and you're on the air, Bruce.
Oh, great. I wanted to talk about a new document I found online from MediaMatters.org.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. It's called The Progressive Minority, Why a Majority Conservative America is a Myth. And they ask a lot of really interesting questions, and it talks about on healthcare specifically, since that what you were speaking about most recently. And 69% of the people believe that it's the government's responsibility. 76 think it's more important than cutting taxes, access to health insurance.
Yeah.
Would you be willing or not willing to pay higher taxes? Willing, 60%. So it just basically talks to the myths that are out there about what are people really thinking in America versus what the media is pushing on us, that these things aren't popular and people aren't willing to pay for them.
Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, I have the study right in front of me here. I was going to riff on it a little bit today, and now is as good a time as any. After the election, they note, and this in the, from the study, after the election of 2006, journalists found their explanation for the Democratic victory. They ran conservative candidates. CBS's Bob Schieffer said, these Democrats that were elected last night were conservative Democrats. The Washington Post wrote, the Democrats' victory was built on the back of centrist candidates seizing Republican-leaning districts. New York Times said, in key races, this was a headline, in key House races, Democrats run to the right. And then they point out, the truth is that that's not the case at all. All 30 newly elected House Democrats who took Republican seats advocated raising the minimum wage, supported changing the course in Iraq, opposed any effort to privatize Social Security, all but two supported embryonic stem cell research, and only five of the 30 described themselves as pro-life on the issue of abortion. 37 House and Senate candidates who promoted fair trade rather than free trade won. Not one single one of them lost. And you're absolutely right that you go through the stats on this thing. The polling shows the public is far more progressive than it's more progressive than a middle ground. I mean, we are overwhelmingly a progressive nation, more than 50% of us. And yet,
Katie Couric on NBC's Today when she was the host of it. She says, this election indicates that this country has become much more socially conservative. And Chris Matthews says, can Democrats ever connect with the country's cultural majority? I'm sorry, we are the cultural majority. And the study just does a great job of laying this stuff out. You know what? For example, government should care for those who can't care for themselves, as opposed to the question, government should help the needy. Or in addition, government should help the needy, even if it means greater debt. 54% of people believe government should help the needy, even if we have to go in debt to do it. And 69% agree with the statement that government should care for those who can't care for themselves. I mean, just, you know, simple stuff. Should we have more services or more spending? Or should we cut services and cut spending? Only 20% of Americans actually want to cut services and cut spending. I mean, this is just incredible. Business strikes a fair balance between profits and the public interest. Only 38% of Americans agree with that. 58% of Americans disagree that business is fair. 47% of Americans say government should reduce the difference between incomes. I mean, you're absolutely right, Bruce. It's an enormous study. You can find it. There's a link to it over at thinkprogress.org, and also it's at mediamatters.org, and it's a absolutely brilliant study and very well done. Dale in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Thanks for taking the call, Tom. Real supporter of you and your books and your works. When I ask about Edwards and Kucinich, Edwards, I really love him on almost all the social and economic issues, but it wasn't long ago he went before the APEC, American Israeli whatever council, and Dewey rattled sabers to make them all real happy. So I want to see what your stance is about peace and war, and why not Kucinich?
Well, I think Dennis Kucinich is a great guy. Dennis and I have spoken together in a number of venues. I think of him as a friend, certainly a close acquaintance. I respect him. I support his candidacy as well. I think he's a good guy. If it came right down to it, though, I'd vote for John Edwards. There is no such thing as at this moment, that may change over time, but that, you know, that's just, and I'm not making an endorsement. I'm just, you know, telling you where I'm at. But there is no such thing as a perfect candidate, Dale. And that's the problem. I mean, that's the bottom line. There is never going to be a perfect candidate. And as I've said before in this program, even if Hillary Clinton, who probably of all the candidates I disagree with on more positions than others, is the candidate, the Democratic candidate, I will work to get her elected because I believe that ultimately it's not the candidate, it's us. If enough of us get out there, if enough of us get active, if enough of us speak up, if enough of us are out in the streets, if enough of us are writing blogs and emails and making calls to our elected representatives, we will push the candidate. Keep in mind that when Franklin Roosevelt ran in 1932, he ran basically as a very moderate, sort of a Hillary Clinton-type moderate conservative Democrat. And he was one of the most powerful progressive forces in the history of America. When Teddy Roosevelt ran for vice president under McKinley, he was basically presenting himself as a rich white guy who was going to represent the interests of rich white guys. And he was one of our most progressive presidents. So I'm in both cases, they changed because the people got out there and got really loud. So I'm not so concerned with the perfect candidate. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Chicken heart.
All right, Republicans, line up for duty. Where are you going? Hey!
Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk. Chicken hawk.
Carl Rove.
He didn't serve.
Dick Cheney.
He didn't serve.
Tom DeLay.
Serve.
And George Bush was A-W-O-L.
Chicken hawk.
Ah, those wonderful chicken hawks. Welcome back to listener-supported radio, our program supported by you, our listeners supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors on your local station that you can support and let them know that you're listening. And also give a shout-out to our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, ecowine.com. and Purina One, 1-866-380-MEOW. In today's New York Times, a hospital study out of Pennsylvania is reported on. They checked out the state's 60 hospitals. Looking at heart bypass surgery, the average of the most expensive hospitals for a heart bypass surgery operation was $100,000. The average in the cheapest hospitals for the same operation was $20,000. Now, you would expect that the $100,000 heart surgery, bypass surgery, would have a higher survival rate than the $20,000 heart bypass surgery. Actually, as, you know, quoting Reed Abelson's article in today's New York Times, two of the highest paid hospitals actually had higher than expected death rates. Expensive medicine may, in fact, be poor medicine. And it turns out that there was no correlation whatsoever between the quality of care, or the outcome, rather, the quality of the outcome, the survival rate, and how much people paid. So it's pretty amazing, pretty amazing. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I really don't understand the conservatives' disconnect on this issue. They're willing to spend blood and treasure to preserve Americans' lives during warfare, but not spend the money in country to protect their citizens. And won't universal health care save businesses money and make them more competitive on a global market?
It will, but it violates their core philosophy. The core conservative philosophy is that government is not here to help people attain their greatest potential, which is what the founders of this country thought, and it's why five out of the six things in the preamble listed in the preamble of the Constitution speak right to that. Right. You know, the general welfare and all that kind of thing. Conservatives believe that the purpose of government is not to help people achieve their highest potential, but rather is to punish or restrain people from acting out their natural and innate evil impulses. And therefore, the core functions of government should be police and army and arguably maybe a fire department, although a lot of conservatives argue that fire departments should be privatized as well. So that's why.
And from your book, Tom, you know, I can't remember the exact stat, but the number of bankruptcies that are due to medical catastrophes.
Half.
That's a lot of big corporations getting bilked out of their money. You think they'd be in favor of getting their cash? And I wanted to ask you real quick, are you familiar with the documentary The Corporation? I just saw it the other day. It's fantastic. And
I saw it a couple of years ago, or a year or so ago when it first came out, and I agree. It is really well done, and it echoes a lot of things that I wrote about in my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And there's also a chapter about it in We the People, which is this 120-page comic book I did that I frankly think is probably one of the very best books I've ever done on American politics, the history of American politics and the history of America, by and large. So, Sean in Sacramento, California. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to tell you I have some experience in this field. I'm a Medi-Cal eligibility specialist.
Mm-hmm.
Medi-Cal, for those in your nations, is the California version of Medicaid.
Right.
And essentially what we see all the time are people coming in who... And what happens if people are very, very indigent, poor, you know, virtually making no money, then quite often they can qualify for some sort of free medical assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if someone's wealthy, then they can usually afford it. But it's those people in the middle that are getting really squashed. Quite often, even if you make a moderate income, what happens, even if you're lucky enough to qualify, it's usually with what's called a share of cost. Which
yeah.
sort of works like a deductible where a person can be responsible for hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars of upfront cost.
Right. This is why 50% of all bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical problems, and 75% of those people were insured at the time that they got sick.
Exactly. And one of the things that I've seen and really experienced is quite often we see those people who are working class coming in. They're working 40 hours a week. And I say, well, you know, and we inquire, do you have any insurance available through your work? And they'll say, yes. But, you know, with me and my children, this is what the premium would be. And often they quote a price that sounds more like rent.
Yeah, yeah, no,
I mean,
people, you know, $1,000 a month, $1,500, yeah, you're spot on, Sean, and good on you for working in the system, in the Medi-Cal system there. Philip in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Philip.
Good morning, Tom. Yeah, I have my own experience last year. I'm self-employed, and mainly I'm the main employee of my company that I own and work for. I'm in the 30% income tax bracket and have to pay my own workman's comp and matching in other words, match myself for Social Security
sure.
and FICA, the stuff
sure.
that's withheld. And I don't have health insurance. Our procedure for a kidney stone was over $10,000.
Wow.
And it was negotiable. In other words, we got it down to $7,500. I after that found out that when you come in without health insurance and you're going to be paying for it yourself, you are charged immediately the highest price that they can possibly get.
Right, because the big insurance companies negotiate lower prices, and so the average, well, not the average, well, actually, arguably, the people who are not insured and who are coming in are, you're right, end up being whacked with the highest prices, and it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Philip, thanks for the call. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, just a few seconds here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Oh, I was going to make a comment about the I found a phenomenon recently. I hope you could may help me understand it, that people like a dumb president. I've talked to several Republicans that should be Democrats, and when I talk to them and break them down, they finally say, well, that guy acts so smart. I don't like it. I
yeah.
think the Republicans understand this.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think that what has happened is that because Bush doesn't come across as so bright, there's this notion that dumb is good. But Clinton was a brilliant guy, still is, and a very decent president. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
So who should be making decisions about energy and transportation and those kinds of policies in the United States? There's really basically two, as far as I can tell, two worldviews on this. One, for example, Dennis Kucinich's, our quote for the day, Dennis Kucinich's statement, if oil companies make excess profits, they should be subjected to a stiff tax on those excess profits. The threat of heavy taxation will send a clear signal to oil companies that price gouging simply will not pay. On the other hand, there are those who suggest that, we should simply let the corporations do whatever they want. They know best. The so-called free market will work it out. H. Sterling Burnett, the senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, ncpa.org, is on the line with us. Sterling, welcome to the program.
Good to be on.
I'm assuming you're taking the latter position.
I'd never say that corporations know best for us. I think we know best for ourselves, and I don't think that that's best. I don't think all the wisdom in America resides in Washington, D.C., and if you're trying to make an energy policy, decide for now and in the future what types of energy and what types of appliances and automobiles we should be driving, I don't think Dennis Kucinich or any of those anointed people up there in D.C. has the knowledge to decide for all of us what we should be doing there.
So you think that the average person is going to be thinking about the impact of their car on global warming, the impact of their car on the environment, on all the cancers caused by burning fossil fuels in the United States, the hundreds of millions of dollars in healthcare costs associated with it. They're going to be considering that as they're making their decisions about how much gas mileage their car should get.
Well, I think that the average person should be able to decide on whatever basis they want to what vehicle they drive.
Even if it destroys this country.
If you think that, for instance, fuel economy is the most important deciding factor when you're purchasing a car, well, we have 60 models of cars sold today that get over 30 miles per gallon and 40 miles that get over 40 models that get over 40 miles per gallon. We don't need Congress to raise the fuel economy standard. It's there. If people want it, they can purchase those vehicles if that's the deciding factor. But if you're a soccer mom who wants to carry the kids to soccer, or you want to haul a boat on the weekend, or do some off-roading or whatever else, those cars that get that fuel economy, the physics indicates that just don't work.
So you're suggesting that even if it means the destruction of the environment, even if it means more 9/11s, that's irrelevant. We should simply leave this up to the oil companies and the car companies.
Well, no, I already told you. I don't think it's the companies. I think it's the consumers.
And them reacting to the consumer marketplace. But the consumer marketplace is in large part driven by the car companies because they're the ones who are advertising the cars to us saying, gee, this is the car you should have. And of course, they're gonna always be promoting the larger cars because they're the most profitable. The more steel there is in the car, the more profit there is in the car.
Well, I think you think consumers are more zombies than I do. I actually believe in free will and believe consumers can make these choices with their eyes wide open. We live in an information age where you can go on the web and find out all sorts of things. But I would also
so it's just fine with you if we have more 9/11s as a consequence of consumers making these decisions.
I think fundamentally we disagree over whether we had 9/11 because consumers were driving cars that were.
Do you really think that if we were not importing oil from the Middle East and we did not have a presence in Saudi Arabia that 9/11 would still have happened?
There's no questions. guess who didn't invade the Middle East and you know where they're having terrorist attacks over in Holland, where they've been very liberal in their allowing immigrants from Arab nations. We would be in the Middle East. This is just a fact. If you want oil flowing to America, if you want to do the best thing for oil flowing to America from the Middle East, we should just abandon Israel. The taps would flow tomorrow.
I'm not saying that we want oil from the Middle East. What we're talking about here is this bill before Congress to raise CAFE standards over the next 10 years. And what it will do is save enough oil that we no longer need to import a single drop from the Middle East. Osama bin Laden was very explicit back in 1998 when he said, I'm going to come and hit you guys if you continue to support a corrupt oligarchy in Saudi Arabia that's keeping oil prices below $100 a gallon, $100 a barrel, which is what he thought they should be at. He felt we were ripping off the sacred, you know, stuff of his homeland. And number two, that as long as American soldiers were in Saudi Arabia, and we positioned them there, and George Bush Sr. positioned them there in 91 for the Gulf War, as long as they were there defiling the sacred territory, he was going to come after us. Those were the two reasons that he gave. He was unambiguous about it. The CIA agrees. Even the neocons like James Woolsey on this program have agreed with that. And Woolsey is now running around right now saying, former director of the CIA, one of the architects of the Project for a New American Century and all this stuff, is running around saying, if we stop importing oil from the Middle East, they're going to stop coming after us.
Well, I guess I fundamentally disagree when they say, if you don't believe as we do, we will kill you. You know, they're killing people all over.
This is not about beliefs. This is about get out of our country.
Now, I would also say that I agree that we need to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, but we're not going to get rid of our dependence on foreign oil. We don't import the majority of our foreign oil from Saudi Arabia.
We're not going to get rid of our dependence on foreign oil as long as we follow your policies.
I'm sorry, sir. What?
We're not going to get rid of our dependence on foreign oil as long as we follow your policies. But if for example, if we use this, if this legislation that Dianne Feinstein has recommended is passed, it'll save 2.1 million barrels of oil a day, which is just about exactly the amount of oil that we import from the Persian Gulf. It'll achieve an 18% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, and it'll save consumers $70 billion. That's about $1,000 per family.
Well,
per
that, year. You know, that's yours and perhaps Ms. Feinstein's assessment. I've never seen these things work that way in the past. When they raised fuel economy in the past, in fact, we imported more foreign oil. Why? Because we made it cheaper to drive, and that meant people did more of it. We've doubled the amount of miles we travel in this country since we first did CAFE standards. Now, why do you not think that, you know, economics indicates that will happen again? We'll still be importing oil, but I also agree that we need to reduce our dependence, and there's ways of doing that. We have oil untapped in this country that we're not going after now, and there's nothing in this plan that will do anything about that. In addition, consumers don't care where they get their oil from so long as they're paying cheap prices. That's just the truth in this country. And they wouldn't be crying about high energy prices if Congress would do something to lower that. And you know what? Nothing in this plan addresses that issue, which is increasing the supply of oil. When you have high demand and limited supply, Economics 101 indicates you're going to have high prices.
So if Congress
wants to face consumers with a bill that will raise their energy prices, that will raise their food prices, because part of her plan is increasing biofuels, which are not necessarily cleaner than gasoline, in fact, in some instances are dirtier than gasoline, won't do as much as they promise, according to the
Sterling. Sterling, I get your point, and you know, neither of us filibustering the other is going to further this conversation, I don't think. But the bottom line here is that you're saying that government really should play no role in this, even though it affects all of us. It affects the commons, it affects the common health, it affects the quality of our air, it affects the quality of our environment, it affects our national defense. Still, government should have no role in it. We should leave it up to the consumers and their relationship with the car companies.
Well, if I thought it would actually improve our national defense, that's the one issue where I think that government has a role to play, is in national defense. And if I thought that this would actually increase our security by somehow restricting foreign oil imports. I mean, we can do that tomorrow. If that's what we're really about, we can just...
I haven't noticed anybody from Zimbabwe flying planes into this country. You know, it was Saudis. It was 14 Saudis, according to the official story, who were flying those airplanes on 9/11.
14 radical Islamicists who think that we are infidels. We're not infidels
because we are occupying their land.
Oil. The Dutch weren't infidels. You know, Theo van Gogh wasn't an infidel because he used Saudi oil.
The situation with Theo van Gogh in Holland is totally and completely unrelated to this, and
well,
was not.
According to you, I see it as a worldwide radical Islamicist terrorist network that are killing people and attacking countries who don't believe.
So let's stop giving them money.
Well, I've got no problem with that, but there's a.
I mean, you want to keep giving them money. You want to have these giant gas guzzlers out there driving around, so people give more money to these people that you say want to kill us. I don't get it.
If that's what you really believe, there's a bill they could pass that would do that: ban imports of oil from Saudi Arabia. Just ban them. They're not going to do that.
Yeah, no, they're definitely not going to do that. Interesting point. Okay, 16 minutes past the hour. Sterling Burnett, a senior fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis, ncpa.org, the website. Sterling, thanks for coming on and mixing it up with me.
Take care.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, we formed an opposition like a rainbow coalition, a sane voice in the wilderness of war. And we were winning as dissenters when we called our representatives. But they kicked the game alive.
Indeed, the ruling oligarchy on their way out, 21 minutes past the hour. The top L.A. legends, number one, the auto industry killed off the streetcars. Yeah, it's just think about this. General Motors and Goodyear, as I recall, were convicted in court back in the, I think it was the 1930s. I don't have it right in front of me. But they came to L.A. and they said to a city that had one of the best public transportation systems in the country, the red cars, they ran everywhere, you know, all over the city, Venice, San Gabriel, the Pacific Electric Railway was huge, 1,150 miles of track, covering four counties and 900 cars. And before that, you know, large system came in, we'll run this for you, we'll privatize this for you, everything will be fine. Okay, great, here, we'll sell it to you. And then they tear it up. Why? Well, more cars, more rubber for the tires, more gas. You know, I just frankly don't think that a private industry should be making decisions that ultimately are going to impact the health and welfare of all of us, not to mention our national security. And B, that consumers, as much as I am an advocate of free enterprise and an advocate of, you know, competition and all that. So, you know, I'm totally, here I am, arguably a capitalist. I mean, I've never given somebody money to start a business and then made money off that. I've always started my own businesses So I'm not sure I'm really a capitalist. A capitalist being, you know, somebody who uses capital, you know, puts a. But I've certainly engaged in free enterprise. I've certainly started a number of businesses and done very well with some of them. And so, you know, that said, I still think that when we're talking about an industry that has the ability, or a collection of industries, in this case the auto industry and the carbon fossil fuel industry, that when we're talking about an industry that has the ability to destroy the planet, that it on a daily basis is causing thousands of cancers, is increasing the rate of emphysema and bronchitis and asthma and childhood diseases, that historically has filled our air with lead, that has, you know, arguably driven down the IQ of many of our children from lead poisoning in our cities, that has led to a junkie-like dependence on a substance that comes from a part of the world that is very unstable, and that has caused us to have to forge alliances with some of the most toxic and destructive elements within that part of the world, because they happen to be the ones who control the oil, and they happen to be the ones who are strong enough and vicious enough and mean and nasty enough to say to their own people, you know, get to the back of the bus. We're going to give this oil to the United States. We're, you know, in other words, the royal families, the powerful few, the oligarchies of the Middle East, nothing that even resembles democracy. They're still having public beheadings, you know, in Saudi Arabia every Friday afternoon. We're talking societies where if you're the wrong religion, you can be put to death. Officially by the state. I'm not just talking about the, you know, the freelancers out there. And this is the quote devil. I don't mean that literally, but this is the devil that we've cut the deal with, to use the metaphor, in order to support these industries. And you know, maybe you could argue back in, you know, 1905 or something, you know, when John Rockefeller had pretty much cornered the market on oil in the United States, and Henry Ford was cranking up, you know, the car companies, and they're actually, in the early part of the 20th century, there were at one point as many as 35 or 40 different car companies out there. And you could argue, well, okay, you know, hey, it was a cool technology. It was a good starting point. But there should have been a reasonable transition. There should have been a point at which, and frankly, I would argue that it should have been back in the 50s and 60s when M. King Hubbard first predicted that in 1974 the United States was going to hit peak oil, and we would have to start massively importing oil. You will remember, in 1970, we were exporting oil. The United States was one of the leading exporters of oil in the world. By 1980, when Reagan came into office, we were importing oil, and we have been importing oil ever since, because we used up a lot of the oil that we have ourselves, and because our need for it grew so much. And that's why Jimmy Carter came along and said, hey, we've got a problem here. The energy crisis is real, and we're going to do something about it. He said we're going to have 20% of all the electricity generated in the United States by solar power by the year 2000. He put solar collectors on the roof of the White House that Ronald Reagan took down. He started programs to wean us off fossil fuels. There was an increase in CAFE standards. I mean, there's a whole variety of things that were done to help this country no longer be vulnerable to wacko governments in faraway places, A, and B, be engaging in an energy policy that is frankly destructive to us. And I think that's one of the highest values of government. And it's one of the places, because it affects the commons, because it affects the national security, because it affects the quality of life of all of us. And, of course, a conservative would say only the national security issue, the military issues, because that's what conservatives are about. I'd take it even beyond that and say, you know, the quality of life of all of us is being harmed by a failure to raise CAFE standards. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is like crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attack Iraq to get my fix. I love oil. I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh,
conservative, we are just way too spoiled. Oh yeah. Glow is heating up, you know it's starting to boil. Gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. I saw the signs, but
and hey, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and join the Tom Hartman blog and start blogging. It can put you in the running for our book giveaway today. At the end of the show, our producer David Poole, in his own inimitable way, will pick what, in his opinion, is the best comment of the day over at the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. It could be serious, funny, whatever, and we will send that person a free autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. So blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, and we'll have a good time. And just to put a fine point on the argument that Americans really should be able to make their own decisions about what they want to drive because soccer moms want to safely drive their big SUVs, the journal Pediatrics, peer-reviewed medical journal, reported on a study that was done by the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia looking at injuries among children in car crashes, comparing children in SUVs versus children in non-SUVs. And this, I'm quoting from the study. People who use an SUV as a family vehicle should know that SUVs do not provide superior protection for children occupants and that age and size appropriate restraints in rear seating for children under 13 are critically important because of the increased risk of a rollover crash. So SUVs are not safer, and in fact, they're more likely to roll over. Among SUVs, midsize and small SUVs had similar injury risks, which were 2 times higher than large SUVs. Compact extended cab pickup trucks present a unique risk to children. Child occupants in the rear row of extended cab pickups face a 5-fold increase risk of injury in a crash as compared to rear-seated children in all other types of vehicles. You want your kids to be safe? Get your basic car. Get your basic sedan. That's, you know, that's according to this study, that's where it's at. They were looking at, in fact, children who were not properly restrained in car seat, booster seat, or seatbelt during an SUV rollover were at a 25-fold greater risk of injury as compared to appropriately restrained children. Of course, that has to do with restraints, not just SUVs. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mark in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Great to talk to you, Tom. I've got 2 points to make. I'd like to get your reaction. First of all, I think a lot of these people, like your last guest, are really in favor of what I call lazy capitalism as opposed to laissez-faire capitalism, meaning that they like to take the easy money off the top and not deal with the consequences such as pollution to the, you know, in the environment and how they treat the employees and such.
Well, they're following one of the prime imperatives of laissez-faire capitalism, which is to internalize profits and externalize costs. And the costs that they're externalizing, that they're dumping on we the people, on government and on all of us taxpayers and everybody else, are the costs of everything from the increased cancers associated with fossil fuels to global warming to the fact that we are, you know, feeding all kinds of cash to radicals in the Middle East.
Exactly. And my second point is something else that he said was that limited supply and unlimited demand, you know, means prices go up. People need to understand that, you know, we're in Iraq for oil, but not necessarily in the way that most people conventionally think of it. The oil that's in Iraq would definitely lower our price per barrel and possibly even
crash.
It could crash the market so much that the Saudi royal family would be in grave jeopardy. And, of course, we know how close Bush is to the Saudi family.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The old saying, don't look at what people say, look at what they do. And
exactly.
And what we did was we tripled the price of oil. I mean, you know, the price of gasoline.
We're keeping the Iraqi oil out of the market.
We're
That's intentionally
right.
destroying their infrastructure to keep that oil out of the market.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can say intentionally with any certainty, but that is certainly what has come out of it. And typically what comes out of situations is what people, when they went into them, had in mind. So, you know, point well taken, Mark. Thanks very much. Gary in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Tom. Blink twice if you don't believe in the habeas corpus law.
Hey, yeah, you know, we have an issue with the oil companies because they run our everyday life. Essentially, oil companies dictate American policy towards, through our politicians, towards the cost. The actual cost of oil today wouldn't be nearly as expensive as we're paying for it if it weren't for that.
And because...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm missing something here. How?
Okay. The tension between the Middle East, or the alleged tensions going on between Iran, who could really not afford not to export oil to us, has driven the futures price of gasoline way up. And we're being charged not what the oil can be bought for today, but what the oil can be bought for 3 or 4 months from now if we're involved in a war, if they cut supplies to us, if.
Right. You're talking about futures prices on oil, not on gasoline.
That's right.
Because you know, we're actually importing gasoline right now as well.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Which is pretty bizarre.
Yes. It's very bizarre. But we have a president who is actually on the side of corporations against Americans.
Yeah, no,
literally.
You're spot on, and that's exactly the problem. Well said. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, listening on WIC. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's my pleasure to speak with you. And, you know, you have a high degree of integrity, and this is why I'm asking you this question. I read a lot, and I'm familiar with Guillaume's Solar Living book and the Solar Living Institute's work, and some of the facts that they state have me totally confused. One is that if we had a 100-square-mile area and we set up solar panels, that we could supply at our current consumption rate all of the United States electricity. Okay,
it's
so that's
not inconceivable if it's, you know, if it was in the desert in Arizona. The problem is then you have a highly centralized system. I mean, right now about, I believe 17% of all the electricity generated in the United States is lost in transmission losses going over long lines. And that argues for a decentralized system. So rather than trying to find 100 square areas of the Arizona desert and then run high tension lines all over the country, what we really need to be doing is putting panels on the roofs of every house.
Right, and I'm an electrician, so I would love to do that, Tom. But what I'm curious about is how does Kyoto play into that, and will this cost us a lot in taxes and things like that?
Yeah, Kyoto, with regard to the United States, is not a factor. It ain't happening. But the step two, I mean, obviously, Andre, where we need to go is off fossil fuels. I agree with Al Gore's suggestion. I believe it's Al Gore's suggestion that we consider very seriously a carbon tax, and that we shift our tax system, since tax systems drive public policy. For example, the reason why we have such high levels of people with mortgages instead of paying rent is because it's tax deductible. You use tax policy to change behavior. And I think that we can use tax policy to get us off carbon and get us onto renewables. And I would love to see a tax system in the United States where electricians like you can be putting solar panels on houses like mine, and you know, you're making a living and I'm getting my electricity from somebody other than Saudi Arabia, you know, via their oil, via the power plant down the street, which is owned by PGE here in Portland, which used to be part of Enron, and is making a very nice profit. Thank you very much. And you know, that's the direction that I think we should go. But well said, Andre. I just want to play very quickly this clip of Jimmy Carter. This is from June 15th, 1979.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Yeah, and then he added,
moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
If we had simply done, if Ronald Reagan had not been elected, if Jimmy Carter had been reelected, and we had simply done what Carter was already put into place. If we had simply continued what Ronald Reagan rolled back, what Reagan did away with, if we had simply continued what Carter was doing, 9/11 never would have happened because we would not be importing oil from the Middle East. We wouldn't have had war in the Middle East. We wouldn't, you know, it would have been like, you know, okay, so Saddam wants to take Kuwait. It's one kingdom versus another kingdom. You know, let him fight it out. It's not our issue because it's not our oil. We don't have to worry about it. I submit to you that the election of Ronald Reagan not only began the destruction of the American middle class, it led directly to 9/11 via these policies. Right after the break, The Independent, a new story in The Independent from England. Scientists have criticized a major review of the world's remaining oil resources, warning that the end of oil is coming sooner than governments and oil companies are prepared to admit. And your calls. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Be fearless. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Alan Rader on the line with us for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Alan, it looks like Scooter Libby's going to prison.
I think it does. And, you know, I mean, I hate to be unpopular, but I don't believe in prison unless it's we need to get people away from violence. So I have a soft spot in my heart for jailbirds. As you know, I have a lot of friends who have been in jail, are in jail now. What can I say?
Yeah, you know, a lot of Native societies, Aboriginal and Indigenous societies, have this notion that that people are basically in harmony and in balance, and when they misbehave, that the job of society is to bring them back into balance, and so they do things to try to recover people, and we have this notion that because people are essentially evil, when they misbehave, we need to punish them, you know, to drive the evil out of them. I think it's an old puritanical streak, but I tend to share your perspective. Although at the same time, if this is the thing that will cause Libby to flip on his boss, I'm not sure I'm opposed to it at all.
I do not think there's a chance in the world he's going to flip. I really don't. I just think he's too loyal. But we'll
or too
see.
Afraid. Or too afraid.
We'll
I mean, it's
see.
Like working for the mob, you know. Yeah.
Speaking of courts and things like that, the Supreme Court today came up with a 5-4 decision that dismissed a convicted murderer's appeal because he filed 2 days late. Now, this was a federal judge mistakenly gave him a 17-day deadline to tell the court whether he intended to file an appeal. But because it was 2 days late, a 5-4 decision, I'm sure you can guess who the five were, would not allow his appeal.
Wow. Kennedy has joined the dark side and become one of the fascist five, in other words. Just totally.
It is really unbelievable.
Yeah. That's really tragic. One of our listeners, Kyle in San Rafael, has a question for you, Ellen, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Hey, Kyle, you're on the air with Ellen.
Good morning, Tom and Ellen. Ellen, were you in the court?
I was not in the court. We actually have a staffer that goes to the court in the mornings to pick up opinions.
Okay. Reading the live blogging from Fire Dog Lake, who've done excellent work throughout, I am noticing that Judge Reggie Walton revealed that he had death threats sent to him and his family. Do you think that had any impact at all on Judge Walton? It's my understanding that from what I'm reading that he was shaken or otherwise concerned, and that he said that he had thrown a few of them away and then realized that he'd better keep them in case something happened.
Well, yes, but the issue is that this on this particular case it was a decision by the Supreme Court.
We're talking about two different things. Kyle's talking about the Scooter Libby trial.
Oh, the Libby trial. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
The Libby trial situation is, and I was not aware of what the previous judge's name was, so that's what I thought you were talking about. In terms of the Libby trial, I have no idea. I mean, I think that given, as I think I've said on this program before, my friend Bob Ney's experience, with the court, I honestly think that there's kind of a buzz around the court that says, we're going to be tough on white-collar criminals. We are going to be tough on government people. We are going to give above the sentence that the prosecutors have asked for, because both in the Ney case and in the Libby case, it's been several months more than the prosecutors asked for. And I think it's kind of the buzz around the judge's coffee house.
Now, it's my understanding that it's 45 to 60 days before the Bureau of Prisons actually assigns a date for him to report, but that it will be within that 45 to 60 day period. It also is my understanding that Libby may file an emergency appeal to keep him out. Do you know anything about the process?
Yeah, I do know a lot about the process. Basically, the Bureau of Prisons, if they had put him in prison today, he would have gone to a local jail, essentially a DC jail or just a temporary lockup. The Bureau of Prisons has a processing sort of technique, and they go through and they actually find a space, and the prisoner's lawyer or the prisoner can request a certain place, certain closer to home. For Bob Ney, it was someplace that had an alcohol program, et cetera. And then it is the Bureau of Prisons mechanism. You go right, actually, when he leaves the court today, he goes to the probation department, surrenders his passport, gets an officer that sort of keeps in touch until he goes to the prison, and then he goes, as I understand it, and I could be wrong, but this is the way it's happened in two or three cases that I know, then the Bureau of Prisons sort of assigns you where they have space and also given some of the judges directions.
Interesting. What else is up in Washington, D.C. today?
Okay. The Supreme Court also upheld a union dues. This was unanimous that states may force public sector labor unions to receive consent from workers before using their fees. And the word of the day, I hate to sound like somebody else, but word of the day is benchmarks. Now the president, when he gave his speech to the construction folks today, basically said that they will use benchmarks on the immigration issue. So not only are we hearing benchmarks in Iraq, Tom, we are hearing benchmarks where it comes to the.
What does this mean? Is this just a rhetorical flourish, or?
Well, it's also that they're going to make $4 to $5 billion available to immediately, you know, help close off the book. Okay,
so
how's it going to be used, and
so
is it really
that, that's money going to Halliburton, right?
It's going to go to somebody, and maybe you and I apply for a contract, Tom.
Yeah, that's it. We'll start a new company, the Tom and Ellen, or the Ellen and Tom, actually, it was your idea. Border Construction Company. Yeah, right. It's totally
wild. Maybe we'll be able to keep them out. I mean, nobody else has been able to do any good.
Yeah, amazing. We could, and maybe we could get a bunch of people on H-1B visas to do the work. And Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thanks.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, as Michael Moore's movie Sicko is about to come out, the rebuttals have already started. We got this email from the NCPA. NCPA President John Goodman co-wrote Lives at Risk, Single-Payer National Health Insurance Around the World. That's the National Center for... Geez, I don't know what it is. It's interesting that they... National Center for Policy Analysis. Oh, this is the same center as our guest from the last hour. And in this news release that they just sent out, they said if you cover this movie, you might be interested in talking with the NCPA president. The common characteristics of these nations are high tax burdens, a lack of technologically advanced diagnostic tools. For example, Canada. At any given time, about 771,000 Canadians are waiting for medical treatment. Across Canada, the median waiting time for referral is 17.8 weeks, nearly 5 months. Canada has approximately 12 PET scanners for diagnosing cancer, compared to over 1,000 across the United States. Only three of the Canadian scanners are available for clinical use in the public health care system. These are the talking points that are being sent out to talk show hosts all across the United States right now. At the same time, in Los Angeles, we have a woman yesterday dying in an emergency room as her boyfriend or husband is calling 911.
My wife is dying. The nurses don't want to help her out.
Okay, what do you mean she's dying?
She's vomiting blood. Okay, they're watching her. They're watching her there, and they're just not doing anything.
Paramedics are not going to pick him up or pick his wife up from a hospital because she's already at one. He needs to contact the county police officers at the security desk there.
This woman died in the emergency room waiting for care in Los Angeles, in the United States. We have with us in the studio an old and dear friend, Louis Malmadrona, of MD, PhD. Your credentials are mind-boggling. Right now, you're the Associate Professor of Family Medicine and Psychiatry at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. You've also practiced in the United States for years. First of all, welcome to the program, Louis.
Thank you.
Let me turn your mic on here. Let's try it again.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And Louis is also the author of a number of books, including Coyote Medicine and Coyote Healing. And your most recent book that I wrote the foreword to is Narrative Medicine, the Use of History and Story in the Healing Process. And this is a brilliant piece of work. Louis, you actually taught medicine at the University of Arizona, you and Andrew Weil down there with the Integrative Medicine Program.
Right.
You practiced medicine in New York at, was it Beth Israel?
Beth Israel.
I mean, you've practiced medicine all over the United States, and now you are teaching and practicing medicine in Canada.
Right.
Is it true what this right-wing think tank sent out to every talk show host in America today, that Canada only has 12 PET scanners? Compared to 1,000 across the U.S.
It can't be true. We must have 12 in the province of Saskatchewan. They're routinely used for cancer diagnostics and for diagnosing heart disease. We even have the Canadian light source in Saskatchewan, which is a synchrotron, which is being used for medical diagnostic purposes. And as far as I know, the United States doesn't even have a synchrotron.
So... It's just, and what about this, across Canada, the average waiting time for referral by a primary care physician until receiving treatment is 17.8 weeks. I made a doctor's appointment for a checkup a while ago. I had to wait, I don't know, about a month, month and a half, but this is 5 months, they're saying.
What they're doing is they're not separating out non-emergency or non-urgent referrals to specialists from urgent or emergent referrals. And I'll give you an example. I was on psychiatry call for our health region on Friday. I got a call from a GP 3 hours away about a 19-year-old with anorexia. I saw her on Monday. So that's a 3-day wait,
right,
for being seen by a specialist.
Yeah.
And what they can, if you have a puzzling rash that's not bothering you, you might wait 4 months to be seen by a dermatologist. If you're really sick, we can admit you the same day. We don't even have utilization review. Nobody asks me ever to justify why I'm admitting someone to the hospital.
Never?
Never. Never.
So then people, I can just imagine all the right-wingers out there going, oh, well, then everybody's going to show up at the hospital and say, admit me. I mean, isn't there abuse of the system if nobody's overseeing physicians?
Well, if you don't need to be admitted, I'm not going to admit you.
I mean, in other words, in Canada, they trust the doctors.
It seems like that.
What an amazing idea. What an amazing. See, here we've got to have companies like, you know, health insurance companies that pay their CEOs $1.6 billion to make sure that the doctors are doing what they think they should be doing. And you've experienced that here.
I've experienced both systems, and I'm convinced that the Canadian system is incredibly better than the U.S. system, based on practicing in both systems.
Yeah. I want to mention, by the way, for our listeners on KPOJ here in Portland, Oregon, where the show originates, that Lewis, in addition to visiting and staying in our home, which it's great to have you, is tonight at 6:45 going to be at the New Renaissance Bookstore. So if you if you're lucky enough to be in Portland, you know, drop by. That's at 1338 Northwest 23rd Avenue at 6:45 tonight. Lewis, some of the main points that I think people are confused about in America is how healthcare can and should work. What in your mind are the major deficiencies in the American system that you don't see as deficiencies in the Canadian system?
Well, one of the main deficiencies is the notion that you can see someone for 6 to 15 minutes and
in the U.S. system.
In the U.S. system. So in the U.S., for example, in psychiatry or in
which is your
practice,
your specialty.
Right, in either specialty, in psychiatry, you maximize your income at 15-minute visits. In general practice, you maximize your income at 6-minute visits. In Canada, you bill for 15-minute increments. And so if you see it in the United States, you make much more money by seeing 8 patients for 15 minutes in psychiatry than you would for seeing 1 patient for 2 hours. In Canada, you get paid the same. Doesn't matter.
So, in other words, if you decide to see a patient for 30 minutes in Canada, you simply bill for 2 15-minute increments for that particular patient, and you get paid.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, you would have to see 2 patients for 15 minutes each
to make
to
the same
paid.
Amount of money.
So,
and studies have shown that it's much more cost-effective in psychiatry to see someone for an hour. They use less medical services. They use less psychiatric services. They use less medication. It's much more cost-effective to spend an hour with someone as a psychiatrist than to spend 15 minutes.
Now, you've also practiced emergency medicine in the United States, and you've practiced family medicine in the United States.
Right.
You're board-certified in a whole bunch of different specialties.
You're
the most incredible overachiever I've ever met in my entire life. Same situation?
Well,
in these other specialties?
In family medicine, for example, in Canada, you get paid for an office visit. It's billed as what's called a 5B. It's a routine office visit. But if you need more time, you can bill for counseling time in 15-minute increments. You can bill for chronic disease management in 15-minute increments. You can bill for psychotherapy in 15-minute increments.
And you can accumulate those for one person. So basically,
right.
The bottom line is you can make your living as a doctor in Canada by providing good medical care, period. End of discussion. You get to control your practice.
Much more so than in the United States.
Yeah, this is really remarkable. Now, the other thing is that you have been a pioneer in many ways in integrative medicine. You're Native American yourself. Your Coyote Medicine, Coyote Healing, some of your work on bringing Native American healing strategies into the Western medicine, conventional medicine, whatever you want to call it, allopathy. And I'm curious how the Canadian system deals with these, quote, non-conventional techniques and systems compared to the American system.
What I've found is it's just not as much of an issue in Canada that the things that I do, I can just do, and nobody cares. I mean, it's fine.
I mean, they do care as long as you're getting, I'm assuming that somebody's
well,
making sure
that impressed with results.
Your patients are getting results.
That's right. When people get better, then people like it. And they say, oh, that's nice. This person got better. And I'll give you an example. I routinely use micronutrients or high-dose vitamins in conjunction with psychiatric medications or sometimes besides psychiatric medications. And therefore, I can use lower doses.
Of psychiatric medications.
Right. And I get fewer side effects. In the United States, that would be a much bigger deal than it is in Canada.
It would be a problem, you mean?
It could be a problem, right.
Yeah. That's very, very interesting. Lewis Melmadrona is with us. His website, by the way, MEHLMADRONA.com.
MelMadrona.mysite.com.
.mysite.com, excuse me. And your email, CoyoteCanada@AOL.com, if anybody wants to drop you a note.
Right.
Coyote Medicine, Lewis Melmadrona, CoyoteCanada@AOL.com. Lewis, thanks so much. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Coming to you every hour.
21 minutes past the hour. Hey, Air Americans, head over to the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, and join our blog and start blogging. David's going to, our producer David Poole is going to pick out the, in his opinion, the best post of the day, or the one that tickles his fancy the most, and we'll give away a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. And we'll let you know about that in about 30 minutes. Lewis is still here in the studio with me, and we're going to just together take a few phone calls here. Linda in Bronx, New York. Hey, Linda, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, Linda?
You always get better, and just keep getting better and better. A couple of things. I'm calling in response to the physician in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, Lewis, and he's still here. Lewis Mamadou.
And great. So, doctor, I'm so glad to hear what you said. I heard the nurse that was on with you on Monday had a very intelligent discussion, and I'm piping in as a physician to say that H.R. 676, Air America, you, other hosts, can't reiterate the notion of getting the support of that bill sufficiently. It really is single-payer health care for everyone, and these scare tactics that the individuals are looking to employ in preparation for Sicko's debut and what have you, yeah, are only that, scare tactics, nothing close to the truth. And I will tell you that eventually everyone's going to get on board the notion that everyone needs to be covered. And I just want to know whether the physician who's your guest there has any comment about this. Thank you.
Lewis? Sure.
Well,
thank you, Linda.
I totally agree that everybody needs to have health care coverage. And what's wonderful about working in Canada is we never even ask what your coverage is or if you can afford something or what kind of insurance you have. We don't even think about it because it's not an issue.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Ron in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Ron.
Yeah, I listen to the corporate media and I hear all these scare tactics and that type of thing. I just want to give you facts that I've experienced personally, because in Buffalo, New York, we live near the Canadian border. So I have an allergy, and I am prescribed a medication called Beclomethevant. In the United States, it's made by GSK, costs $117 a month. In Canada, same basic product, different company, but same basic product, $51 Canadian, which comes out to about 47 or whatever American, for 6 months supply. Okay. Now, I didn't realize this because I'm blind, and my driver didn't ever mention this. You have to go over to get your prescription, your American prescription, co-signed by a Canadian doctor. And I just thought it was a pill pusher. The drugstore that I went to recommended this guy down the road, and we went there, and walked right in. And about the third time I was in there, he was late, and he apologized. He said, you know, I had a person go into anaphylactic shock at the hospital, and I was delayed, and he was very apologetic. All of a sudden it dawned on me. I says, what type of doctor is this? And my wife says, oh, this is a specialist. This was a specialist. I could walk in there anytime. The longest I ever had to delay was 3 days, yet I hear all these scare tactics. Oh, you got to wait 3 weeks to get a doctor. You can't do that. To me, something's working over there. I don't know what it is. I guess the gentleman you have on here is describing some of it, but to me, I think it's a great system. I've experienced it. I've been ripped off by the American system. I've been kicked out of hospitals after 6 months. I don't really have, or 6 hours, I should say. I don't even have any health care. They take me as a poverty case. I have to do my own medication, my own bandaging at home. I mean, so they're doing something right in Canada, and all the fear tactics in the world are not going to convince me that somehow our system is better.
Yeah, well said, Ron. Thank you. Lewis, thoughts?
I totally agree.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty straightforward. Ron said it very well. By the way, with us is Lewis Melmadrona, melmadrona.mysite.com, his website, coyotecanada@aol.com, his email address. He's in Portland tonight at the New Renaissance Bookstore, 6:45 p.m. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I think that the NCPA, they're tied to the ideology of government is not the solution. And, you know, they're trying to say that people can make informed decisions. And I would say that's not the case. I mean, if they could make informed decisions, Bush wouldn't be president. But the solution isn't to force-feed people, which are words I think that I think I may have said guest, but I meant Burnett, tried to put words in your mouth, you know, that you were trying to force-feed feed people, and the solution would be to inform and educate. But
yeah, information is always the key, and it's a really vital thing. Lewis, this meme that it's just a nanny state, you know, it's just, you know, what's your response to that, real quickly?
Explain that again.
The conservatives, they say, oh, you know, you're just buying people's votes by giving them free health care.
Oh, well, you know, certainly that isn't the case in Canada. I mean, there's conservatives in Canada, and they support free health care.
Yeah.
So.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Lewis Malmadrona, Dr. Lewis Malmadrona, MD, PhD, MELMADRONA.mysite.com. His website, his new book, Narrative Medicine. Next time you come on, we've got to talk about the book, Narrative Medicine, The Use of History and Story in the Healing Process. It's just out now. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Civil rights leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. And the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose. 7 little pennies in the newsboy's hand. And you ride right along to Never Never Land.
It's time for the best of the rest of the news when we get on a couple of folks who are out there in the news business with the blogs, with the online magazines, online news sources. Today we have with us Christy Harvey of the Center for American Progress. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress and also does the daily news prep site, miccheckradio.org, over at americanprogress.org. And Christy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. How are you?
Just great. Great to have you here with us. And also, Jim Mottavelli is with us. He is the editor of E Magazine, the website emagazine.com, a great source for the latest and best environmental news. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, can I just say, we also have a print version of that. The name E Magazine makes everyone think that we're only on the web, but we are a print magazine, too.
Yep, and in fact, on your website, you can see the front cover of the current issue and subscribe and all kinds of cool stuff. So,
yeah.
Jim, what do you see as the hottest environmental news happening right now?
Well, right now, Congress is starting to debate the energy bill, and these things always get bloated with a lot of pork. But I think in this case, there are some things that are happening. And you might think that with the Democrats in control, there would be more of a progressive slant to the energy bill. But a lot of things that are happening are indicative of the way big oil and big extractive industries control Congress. And I think this is nowhere more illustrated than what is happening with liquid coal. And top Democrats are the ones circulating a proposal to provide $10 billion in loans for liquid coal. Liquid coal is never going to work. It is a terrible thing. It's going to turn every Toyota Prius into a Hummer in terms of its global warming output. The process produces twice as much carbon dioxide as just does conventional gasoline. So we're going
to because there's a double conversion from the coal to the liquid coal to and then burning the liquid?
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And I've just come back from West Virginia, where I did a tour of mountaintop removal mining. And even if liquid coal itself was clean, the process by which it is extracted, by which coal is extracted, is the worst nightmare you could possibly imagine. The tops of mountains are taken off. The people who live in these areas have their homes destroyed, their foundations shattered. Their water is either eliminated or polluted. It's amazing. Whole hardwood forests, very mature hardwood forests, are taken down and burned as part of the process. And what you got left looks like a mesa in Arizona, completely barren and toxically polluted.
Yeah, I've seen it. They're like moonscapes. Christy Harvey, the Center for American, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, what do you see as the top stories in the news today?
Well, this is a one that's a little bit under the radar, if you will, but I'm obsessed with this news story about a $63 million airplane that can't fly. It turns out over the past few years, Congress has spent $63 million on this airplane that's been developed by DuPont Aerospace. And it sounds kind of cool. The plane is supposed to take off straight up and then go 700 miles an hour. And here's the thing. Number one, the Pentagon says it doesn't really want an airplane that can go straight up and then 700 miles an hour. And then the problem, number two, is for the past 21 years, the plane has only ever been able to get off the ground a couple of feet before it crashes. So basically, Congress has spent $63 million for a plane that can't fly as high as I can jump.
Is this because a particular member of Congress has the manufacturing in their backyard and they've been able to, I mean, is this an example of pork barrel politics?
You are very smart. Of course it is. And I'd like to point the finger directly at Duncan Hunter. This is a San Diego
project.
What a surprise. Shocker. First it was Chris Cox, who is now head of the SEC, and now it's Duncan Hunter, and together they've received something like $54,000 in campaign contributions from this little, it's not DuPont like the chemical company, it's a different, separate group, this little company that exists basically to build this plane that nobody wants and that can't fly. But luckily,
it just boggles my mind whenever I hear stories like this. If I, as a business person, was able to make a $54,000 investment and get a $63 million return, I'd do it in a heartbeat. It seems like the best business in America right now is bribing Congress.
Absolutely. You've got that dead on. And luckily, Congressman Brad Miller from North Carolina finally got wind of this thing and said, no more. So he's holding some hearings that should be coming up next week, I believe, on what the heck they're doing to stop this and how it got so far in the first place.
Yeah, incredible. Jim Mottavelli, eMagazine.com. Jim, what do you see coming down the road, the next weeks, months?
Well, I think this is a very good time for consumers and citizens to lobby Congress to try to get some of the worst things out of the energy bill, because otherwise we're going to get total business as usual. One way is they're going to weaken the fuel efficiency standards for cars. They are, I think they're doing something progressive in talking about a 35-mile-per-gallon standard for cars and trucks. But
yeah, Dianne Feinstein is pushing that, isn't she? Most avidly.
Yeah. But there's already developing a whole lot of loopholes through Congressman Dingell and other Michigan representatives that want to protect the car industry. And they're looking at giving a lot of outs for the industry and loopholes. And I think we could easily achieve a 40-mile-per-gallon standard. The industry could do that in a heartbeat. And it would even be good for Detroit because it would stop hemorrhaging market share to the foreign manufacturers who are producing fuel-efficient cars that people actually want to buy. So
yeah,
it just
boggles my mind. I mean,
it's amazing.
If and this happened 20-some-odd years ago as well, if the car industry had simply been producing these kind of cars, I mean, Chrysler and General Motors and Ford would not be in the kind of trouble that they're in. And it's you know, I'm not in favor of government running industries, but it's so mind-boggling that in the pure pursuit of profit, that the bigger the car is, physically bigger the car is, the more profitable it is when they sell it. And so they've been pushing these bigger and bigger and bigger cars, and it's crazy. Somebody has to say enough already, and you know, they've been doing it frankly to their detriment. And now they're trying to, you know, eviscerate the UAW. It's just awful. Christy Harvey, I'm curious, before I ask you about what you see on the horizon, on the future, you think Scooter Libby's going to serve time?
I actually do. I do think that there is enough of a public outcry that for him to be pardoned before he serves any time, or for him to be able to delay serving his time until he gets the pardon, I just think people will go too crazy, too nuts. And I think that for once the White House might actually have an ear to the ground to see how deeply this could go. What do you think?
And yet, well,
I'd put money on it.
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, you know, Bush is so unpopular right now. He has so little to lose.
That's the scary part.
Yeah, and on the other hand, if Scooter Libby were to start talking, Bush has so much to lose, or at least Cheney has so much to lose, that nothing would surprise me, including a pardon.
Right.
I'm assuming that you're guessing that a pardon is probably not going to happen?
My jury's honestly still out on this one. At this point, I'm saying no, but like you, Tom, I can honestly say that this administration never ceases to surprise me. Just when I think that they've gone as far as they can possibly go, they always take it two steps further. Yeah. So, you know, never say never.
There you go. And looking into the future, what do you see as the emerging stories, those things those storm clouds on the horizon, as it were?
Well, this was interesting. Today, in a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, Senator Patrick Leahy revealed that the White House, surprise, surprise, hasn't been exactly truthful about those missing emails. And you remember, you know, back a couple of months ago when we found out about the secret shadowy RNC email system that they set up at the White House so they could do their secret business without anyone seeing it. When that was exposed, Congress said, okay, let's see the emails, and you can't claim White House advantage. You have to turn these over. And the White House, of course, said, oops, we lost those emails. Those emails are gone. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Rosemary Wood's granddaughter is working here now.
Right. And she hits Control-Alt-Delete a lot.
That's right.
But today, Patrick Leahy said that the White House has admitted to him personally that they have those emails. Of course they were on a backup server, but they just haven't given them over yet. So I think that's going to be the new twist in, especially the subpoenas we saw yesterday, that's going to be the new twist that we're going to see is what is in these emails, why the White House won't turn them over, and the battle over whether or not they have to.
Well, between these emails and the two subpoenas of Harriet Myers and Sarah, what's her?
Sarah Taylor.
Sarah Taylor, thank you very
yes.
much, of Karl Rove's office. I'm sensing that there's going to be a huge battle over executive privilege on this.
There really is. But the thing is, these emails cannot be considered executive privilege because they were specifically set up to be sent from private accounts and outside of the executive system. So you
right.
can't set up something to bypass the official system and then scream foul when someone actually wants to see what's outside of the system.
So do you think they'll be able to stonewall until Bush is out of office?
I think they're really going to try, but I think for once they're not going to be able to do it. I just don't think they're going to be able to get away with it this time, especially now that Congress is standing up and saying, we're not going to take it anymore. Here's some subpoenas. Come in here and tell us what you know. We'll see.
From your lips to God's ears. Let's hope you're right. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications, and Jim Motivalli, the editor of eMagazine, eMagazine.com. Jim, Christy, thank you both so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Oh, it's 105 degrees. Global warming. Uh-oh. We have a crazy alert here for you. It's, whoops, wrong one. Here we go.
Baby, I'm crazy.
Yeah, well, yesterday, again, could this be global warming side effects? Yesterday we reported that senior Minnesotans, I'm sure this was enjoyed by our listeners in Minneapolis on AM 950, are taking their clothes off for a calendar. Well, apparently in Seattle, where we're on Talk 1090, it's getting even a little stranger. Drunk driving is bad. This is from the Associated Press. Drunk driving is bad, but drunk driving while naked could be worse. I'm telling you, this another unintended side effect of global warming. A Bellevue State Patrol trooper pulled over an SUV on Interstate 90 in the Seattle suburb of Bellevue after observing it driving erratically around 1:20 a.m., and the trooper found both the driver and his female passenger were naked with alcohol containers in the vehicle. They apparently had been interrupted in the middle of an intimate act, said the trooper. A 19-year-old Seattle man was arrested for investigation of drunken driving, a gross misdemeanor, and investigation of embracing while driving, which the officer said was a misdemeanor. embracing while driving is illegal. The 20-year-old Seattle woman was cited for being a minor in possession of alcohol. He said the patrol did not release their names. And from our crazy alert to our perhaps an appropriate segue to our winner of an autographed copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It by Tom Hartman. You can, the winner from our blog over at airamerica.com. First of all, the runners-up, or maybe the losers, I'm not sure. A few here. David says, here's one. This is submitted by YB Normal. David Poole is the greatest person in the world. Generous and kind. Long may he live. Not going to risk my life by holding my breath. Rather, I'll just suck up, and I'm already blue. And he says, this is all very true, but not the winner. Plus, if you want to kiss up to me, you need to spell my name right. There's no E in pool. So, okay, here's another one who, another runner-up. Finally got to this page. Sadly, driven insane by the process. Now I need health care, but I live in a medieval country where mental illness is not treated by not being treated. Or at best paid 10% of insurance if it was not real. I guess I'll have to go to King County Hospital or King Hospital in L.A. where I can die in agony on the floor. Another runner-up. And another runner-up. I want to have David Poole's baby. Sometimes hypnosis, you know, I guess that's a signature. Sweet. But here's our winner. This is the one David chose. It's from Libear, L-I-B-E-A-R, blogging over at airamerica.com, Tom Hartman page. Hi, Tom. I'm curious about John Edwards' hair. Could you spend all of the time you have, plus the post-interview hour, focusing exclusively on John Edwards' amazingly well-cut hair? The mainstream media never touches on the interesting personal tidbits like follicle care for presidential candidates. And since I'm bald, I'd like to hear all about his hair, especially in relation to his health care plan, but not really, just the hair. Good one. So congratulations and thanks for participating. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jimmy in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Jimmy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, man? I think I'm going to wind up touching on three things here. Number one, I live up in British Columbia. I'm from America, grew up in Northern Virginia and all that. And the waiting lists in BC are different from Saskatchewan and Alberta. I had to have an MRI done, and it actually took me 3 months to actually get one done. And there's, you know, a fair amount of other people who are waiting for surgeries and whatnot, and you know, on a 18-month waiting list. So that kind of needs to be cleared up here. But as far as Saskatchewan, they are way ahead of British Columbia as far as that goes. Number two, I was wondering, have you seen? I just saw a documentary yesterday called "The Crude Awakening," the oil crash. And it was like I learned so much from watching it. Like, you know, I'm basically scared now. And number three, global warming. I live in the interior of British Columbia, well, relatively close to Vancouver. And recently we had the Fraser River water level went up 17 feet within 3 months because the interior glaciers were melting so fast. So that's basically all I got to say.
The river I live on is up quite a bit, and I'm not sure exactly why, and I'm a little concerned about that. Jimmy, thanks for your story with regard to peak oil and all that. Yeah, we've got a serious problem, and it's a problem that we can solve if we can marshal the political will. The problem is that there's a lot of people who are making a lot of money off the problem not being solved. But I don't think that it's insurmountable at this point. The world's leading scientists tell us we still have a few years. And so, you know, frankly, I think we need to move in that direction. Eleanor in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Eleanor.
Hi, Tom. I'm sorry, I'm a bit nervous here. I had some comments on the healthcare systems in Canada versus the United States. I am from Canada. I'm now living in the United States, and I have experience certainly with both systems. And there are differences. There are significant differences, but I got to say that the Canadian system, I believe, is superior because for several reasons. One of the things that conservatives talk about is a high taxation in Canada, and that's true. Canada, each province subsidizes the health care for their residents. But if you consider what the difference is, how much more you're paying in income taxes up there versus down here, how much you pay in your insurance premiums, your deductibles, and your co-pays and all of that stuff, you end up with more money in the bank in Canada than you do down here. So
that's because you don't have people like William McGuire making $1.7 billion.
Exactly. And the other part of that is that in Canada, you might have one office staffer doing all of the billing for the insurance. Down here, I have seen practitioners where they've got like half a dozen staff people doing nothing but billing.
Yeah,
and that,
no, it's an absolute mess.
Yeah, and it's got to be adding on. And
that's you know, you're absolutely right, Eleanor, and that's where the inefficiency is, and that's where the health insurance companies are making their money. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders will be here, Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls. Anything goes Friday, call in on any topic, and we'll do our blog contest again for the best blog over at AirAmerica.com. Check it out. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.